Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Yeah, Dreamliner is up, middle of the afternoon. A special Friday start. I had to ask Mr. Skilling to step aside so I could accommodate Mr. Brian Dennehy today, who has to get to the theater, and this is the latest he could do it. So I'm happy to do it. Brian, welcome. Always good to see you.
Hey, yeah, guys.
Brian is in to do The Iceman Cometh at the Goodman, has been doing it, and will be doing it for several more weeks. I know it's mostly sold out, but there's always a ticket or two if you're interested, and I think we're going to really sell some tickets here. When we go through Eugene O'Neill, who wrote The Iceman Cometh, if you look at Eugene O'Neill's bio, it makes the Kennedy family look like a sitcom. It really does. I mean, I know you and I have talked about this. I saw you and Nathan Lane do a panel at the Goodman before the play started. Nathan Lane playing the part you played about 22 years ago at the Goodman. Sure. And you're playing the part of Larry. And Eugene O'Neill's personal life was the biggest train wreck you could possibly imagine. And he took that energy, as negative as it was, and made these incredible plays, of which you are participating in one, which is about a bunch of losers in a bar for 4.5 hours.
He, when he was approximately, I guess, 19 or 20, he had been thrown out of, I think, both Princeton and Harvard. It's not so much that he was thrown out, he just didn't bother going. And so eventually they asked him to leave. I guess he was about 20, 21. He wound up, in those days, it was the Lower West Side, a place called Jimmy the Priest's, which was about as low down a saloon as you could be in. This would have been 1904, 1906. The play actually takes place in 1912. But he stayed there for 4 years until eventually he had an unsuccessful suicide attempt, combination of alcohol and Veronol, and was discovered after 4 days of being in his room above Jimmy the Priest's. I think it was Jimmy the Priest. There were three or four bars that he describes basically in the play. And began the recovery, which, of course, ultimately resulted in the Nobel Prize. It's a hell of a price to pay to become a Nobel winner, to, at the moment of your birth, to turn your mother into a morphine addict, which he did. She became a morphine addict as a result of giving birth to Eugene O'Neill. He was a terrible drunk. He screwed up his family, various families that he had, two of his children. There were three. Two of his children were virtual suicides. One was an actual suicide, and the other one was essentially drank himself to death.
At the age of 40.
Yeah. So it was a bit of a mess. However, he, at the same time, like a lot of artists, created some of the world's greatest work, most of the great stuff, which was not appreciated at the time. It wasn't until later. And, of course, Eugene O'Neill's luck being what it was, there's my phone, folks. I can't believe it.
All right, that's Eugene from the grave. Stop talking about me!
That's his agent.
All right, put another dollar in the jar. All right.
In any case,
why don't you get your phone settled? I'm going to take a little break.
Yeah, take a break. And I do have a tendency to go on about O'Neill. I apologize.
Call from the grave from Eugene O'Neill. More with Brian Dennehy after these. Brian Dennehy in the studio. We're talking about the play he's in at the Goodman Theater, The Iceman Cometh. And Eugene O'Neill, who wrote the masterpiece, just had a mess of a family. His daughter married Charlie Chaplin. She was 18. He was 54 at the time. After that happened, he never talked to her again. That's just one of the highlights of many in the family history of Eugene O'Neill.
And they had a pretty successful marriage because they had about 8 or 9 kids. So,
well, she was at the perfect age to have that.
Definitely not firing blanks at that late age.
The little tramp.
Yeah, that's right.
Which one was the tramp? I get mixed up.
No, she was actually a nice lady. I met her. She was years later. This would be 30 years ago. She was going out with a friend of mine, Walter Bernstein, a wonderful New York writer, and came in from Switzerland regularly to visit with him, and I got to know her a little bit. She was Very, very sweet lady. But
did she have a tragic ending?
We didn't talk too much about Eugene. Well, what happened was that she wound up very much like one of the main characters in More Stately Mansions. She wound up locking herself away, essentially, for the last 2 years of her life in this estate that she had in Switzerland, in Vevey, and kind of becoming incommunicado. So, I mean, the O'Neill seed was definitely present with Una as well. So it's, it was the whole family. I mean, the sane male member of the O'Neill dynasty was Eugene's father, James O'Neill, of course, who was pilloried in Long Day's Journey Into Night. But O'Neill realized late in his life that his father was compared to Gene and compared to Gene's grandfather and his kids, he was probably the only sane male member of the family. So it's again, out of that comes great art, and certainly did in his case. I mean, he wrote four or five of the greatest plays ever written in this country, and he wrote them at a time when his career was non-existent. And, of course, given his luck, it was about 2 years after he died that Jason and Jose Quintero came along, revived Iceman Cometh, and all of a sudden Eugene O'Neill was this great playwright, which he had been since the 20s. It's a long, tragic story, which is true of all Irish lapsed Catholics.
Yeah, here he comes.
So there
here
you go.
It comes now, Brian. Let it out. Just get it out.
No. I still have my rosary beads clutched in my hand, and I was in confession in, let's see, 1973, I think, was the last.
You got it all out then? Nothing's happened since then?
It's been a very boring existence.
Did you or Nathan Lane, Nathan Lane plays Hickey in the play, did you or Nathan Lane say this in an interview you did recently, that you never stop being a Catholic, no matter if you don't go to church? Was that you?
It's a quote. It's actually a quote of Pete Hamill, another famous lapsed Catholic, who says there's no such thing as an ex-Catholic.
You're always a Catholic, somehow.
Yeah, so you can't, I mean, if you were grabbed by the nuns at an early age, which I was, and then the brothers and the priests in high school, although in recent events involving pederasty certainly didn't seem to exist when I went to school. If anything, it was more from the standpoint of sadomasochism. But that has a tremendous effect on you. Although when I was in high school, I was definitely a contrarian, and they were very tolerant about it. And that was the 50s, so it was an interesting time to be in the church, or trying to be in it and out of it at the same time, which is what I seem to be doing.
So this play is, as I mentioned earlier, about these losers that hang out at this bar and then have a moment where they think, okay, that's it, I'm not a loser anymore, I'm heading out.
Well, what it's really about is O'Neill's constant refrain in his writing, which is every human being requires some kind of illusion to get them through life. And to the extent that you try to lose your illusions about yourself or about your life or about the importance of the existence you have, to the extent that you're convinced by psychiatrists or psychologists or doctors or wives or therapists that illusions are bad, that's a disaster. You figure out what your illusions are, understand that they are illusions, and cling to them. And if you require booze or drugs to maintain them in a reasonably sane way, that's okay. The worst thing you can do is lose your illusions. The worst thing you can do is look in the mirror and actually see who you are looking back, because it's not a pretty picture. It's never a pretty picture. Now, Cohen, this is Eugene O'Neill. But the fact is, it's an interesting point of view. The same was always true. I mean, Long Day's Journey, which is a biographical play, I mean, it's all about these illusions that all of these family members have about themselves and about where they came from and what they're going to do. And O'Neill, even O'Neill himself, I mean, he spent most of his life in a small room writing, and which made his personal life so disastrous and so difficult. But that's what great artists do. He had no illusions about what was outside for him. I mean, he made a lot of money, and he spent a lot of money, he drank, he married several times, and did all the things that people do. But the fact is that he had this ferocious honesty about himself and about life, and that's what he wrote about, and thank God he did.
Well, the play, as I've witnessed myself last Saturday is everything that Brian just said coming at you for 4.5 hours with 3 intermissions. So you have a break there to regroup.
And to go to the bathroom, and which you need to do. The thing about the play is that it's interesting. Mary McCarthy, who was a famous critic of the 40s and 50s, wrote for The New Yorker, said once had an interesting quote about O'Neill, which she had a love-hate relationship with his work, but she said an interesting thing. She said, he's not a good playwright, but he's a great one. And that's a really good definition of it. What happens is it's like being a victim of a tsunami if you're in the audience. You cannot resist it. You can't resist his passion. You can't resist his honesty, his overwhelming tide of words and ideas and feelings and loss and triumph. And eventually the audience just surrenders to it, and they realize at the end of 4.5 hours that they have experienced something that they rarely experience these days, which is genuine, profound artistry.
Holy shnikes!
Is that for me?
No, son, that's for me.
That's a little piece from Tommy Boy, in which Brian Dennehy starred with Chris Farley. Brian in the studio with me.
And Bo Derek, who was also a little piece in that.
That was the point of that little piece, that's for you. Bo Derek is for you.
Yeah.
Keep your meat hooks off of her.
I didn't get her either.
Okay.
In fact, nobody on that picture did. John Derek was around quite a bit, as I remember.
Why, were you trying?
No. Actually, I did a couple of pictures with her. I did a picture called 10 with her years
ago. That was your first movie, right?
No. It was the first movie where I was in a successful movie.
Oh, is that?
When your movie is successful, that always becomes your first movie. But that was because of Dudley. And Bo, and that, remember that hairdo she had with the beads, and that was all prominently featured. Blake Edwards, a really really smart director.
You were the bartender in 10.
Played the bartender. And
so how many movies did you do before that? Before we get to 10,
God, I can't remember.
Because I thought when I first met you, you said that was your first movie. I guess you lopped off.
No, that was the first movie where, like I say, where you know it was kind of a hit. I think I had done Semi Tough before then, which was kind of a hit.
Oh, okay,
too.
That's good.
But I don't remember that stuff.
So you and Bo and Dudley Moore.
Well, we were all in Mexico together, Las Hadas, but Dudley, who was a pretty good drinker, was a brilliant piano player. He was a composer. He actually composed music, and we were in that lounge where we actually shot. And of course, we'd always wind up. We were staying at this resort. We always wind up there at night, and he would sit down at the piano, and Julie was in it too, Julie Adams, and he would Julie Andrews, and he would play for hours, and it was one of those elegiac times, very special times, you know, being in that picture and getting to know him. I did a couple of pictures with him. I did a picture called Foul Play with him too. Very special guy. Had all kinds of physical problems, which ultimately killed him too young, but just a great guy, fantastic guy. Very funny, very sweet man.
Speaking of Tommy Boy, do you think of Chris Farley? He was Eugene O'Neill-like in the way
he died not too far from here.
In the Hancock building.
Yeah, I mean, that was a tragedy. He had a wonderful family. Most of them, I think his dad just passed away a couple of years ago. But he had two brothers that he was close to, and his mother and father, I got to know that. I think they're from Wisconsin.
Yes.
And great people. So he did not have, you know, the John Belushi thing, which was who had a very difficult father, you know, violent father, apparently. Because Chris had a great family life. They loved him, and they were close to him. So who knows? You know, it's the demons. I mean, it's amazing that I'm even here compared to the stuff that I did, you know, 20, 30 years ago, some of which you weren't in on, whether you want to admit it or not.
Watch your mouth.
But you know, we were all crazy in those days. I was older than Chris, and so I had survived a lot of it, but he was still fighting his way through it, and he didn't make it. So.
On that movie, were there times when he just seemed out of it?
He was actually pretty good. He had promised Lorne Michaels, is it Lorne Michaels? The Saturday Night Live guy who produced it, that he would be good, and he was. I mean, we're in Toronto, and he would periodically drag me and David and whoever else he could get.
David Spade.
to go to, I think it was called, it was either called the Gold Rail or the Brass Rail, which was a topless joint. And he would sit there at that bar and slip $100 bills into the wardrobe of various strippers. And, I mean, it was interesting, you know, for 10 minutes. But then, you know, either the evening proceeds or it doesn't. But it can't stay the same. So I would always say, listen, I got to, you know, I'm at the age now where I'd rather go home and put on ESPN. So, and he would spend a fortune, you know, and he would always say, she's going to college, I'm helping her with her tuition. So she'd have $300 sticking out of her G-string. I said, yeah, I wonder what she's studying. But he was a terrific guy. He was just the nicest, sweetest guy. He came to a couple of openings of mine in New York, and... yeah, it was one of those tragic things. I mean, John Candy, who was a friend, was a similar situation. It just, you know, he couldn't kill the demons with the pizza, I guess. And John, of course, was a smoker. I mean, he was a heavy smoker. And, of course, Belushi himself, who had his own demons. A lot of those guys. I mean, Sam Kinison, who was a very good friend of mine. And I love Sam. And we thought Sam had beaten it.
Well, he dies in a car accident.
Well, it wasn't even his fault. Some guy came across the divider.
Right, hit him head on.
And ran him head on, and he was clean. I mean, just to show you, you know, the irony of life and death. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of those guys were just, you know, they had their devils and their demons, and a lot of us did. I mean, I had a couple myself, but once you get past a certain age, all of a sudden... Yeah, and there's nothing more boring than a 45-year-old man making a fool out of himself. And so things have a tendency to wind down. I got married to a great lady, and I'm still married to her, and my kids have all turned out great. I've been a lucky guy.
I know you said to me one time, it's one thing to portray a train wreck, it's another thing to be a train wreck. And when you cross over into being a train wreck, you're...
And I know a lot of guys who are very, very famous who got out, in many cases just in time, you know, just barely got out. In fact, Belushi's death had a lot to do with a lot of guys cleaning up, because those days, those late 70s, early 80s, were mad times. And you know, most of the guys made it, but some of them didn't. And Chris, for some reason, that was later on, it was delayed, but it was... You know, it was one of those things where he couldn't get control, and you have to kind of get control. So,
all right, hang on, Brian Dennehy with me for a few more minutes. This is WGN. All right, a few more minutes with Brian Dennehy, who is in town at the Goodman Theater in The Iceman Cometh, and Eugene O'Neill wrote this masterpiece.
But you know, we should talk for a minute about Bob Falls, who did such an extraordinary job directing this thing. He and I had done it before. But his work in this thing is masterful, and it's a fantastic production. And the direction of any play like this is so critical because it's so complicated, and the characters are so different and so hard to control. You've got 8-10 people on stage at a time, and the focus has to shift back and forth so that the audience is keeping track of everything that's going on. Amazing job of directing. I mean, the guy has been a prominent Chicago and New York director for years, but his work in this is and he and I go way back.
You're like the Lennon McCartney of Chicago theater here.
Yes, in more ways than one.
Here we go. Let it out, Brian. Come on.
No. I love him, and he's an amazing director. He's the best director I've ever worked with, and he just gets better and better and better, and he works really, really hard. He worked very hard on this show.
And is it going to New York?
Probably not. And that was to be expected. It's an extremely expensive proposition. There are 18 or 20 people in the cast, depending upon which ones you feel like you can do without. It runs 4.5 hours, which means you can only do 6 a week. You can't do 8. You can't do a matinee. Spacey did one day where he did a matinee on Saturdays, which means he was on stage 9 hours.
Kevin Spacey. Because that might be a nickname for an actor that you would know and we don't.
Yeah, no, Spacey. No, that's true. I know a few Spaceys.
Oh, that guy.
I'm one myself. but it's very difficult to make the numbers work, especially these days.
And to do a classic like this, is this kind of
a tough sell altogether, because with the world we live in,
you
the
know,
attention span shrinking,
well,
you're
I
selling
mean,
a 4.5 hour product here when people start flipping the channel after 2 minutes.
We live in the world of Jersey Shore, okay? We live in the world of whatever junk reality show that is on television. Now, you know, there are people who go to the Broadway theater, obviously, for other reasons. But to find theater audiences as consistently intelligent and demanding and involved as you find in Chicago is not going to happen. That's why a play like this is done here. That's why the Goodman Theater exists. That's why Steppenwolf exists. That's why another 100 or so theater companies exist in Chicago, because of the audiences. Because you have people who want to hear it, they want to see it, they want to experience it. They stay, they get involved, they listen. And Chicago is unique in this country, and in many ways around the world, for the attention that's paid, the care that's demonstrated for the theater. The Goodman Theater is a leading part of that, but so was Steppenwolf, and so is Shakespeare on the Pier, Barber's Company. This is a real theater town.
And that's how you met the director, Bob Falls, by doing a play here many years ago.
At a company which doesn't exist anymore, Wisdom Bridge. We did a little Irish play called Rat in the Skull, very tough-minded little play, funny, hilarious, scary play, which, of course, was received beautifully by the Chicago theater audiences. And that's why somebody like me, somebody like Nathan, somebody like Stephen Ouimet, all these amazing actors want to work here, mainly because of the audiences. They are so receptive, and they have such intelligence and concern, care about what they're seeing. So you do a play like this, which is a difficult, hard play to do, long, arduous for the audience as well as everybody else. And at the end of it, at 10 minutes to 12 at night, they stand up and scream. And in New York, you might have half the audience left. Everybody else is headed for the suburbs. But it's not the same here.
And Nathan Lane is doing the part you did 20-some years ago.
And he's brilliant. I mean, Nathan Lane is as good an actor as I've ever worked with, and better than most. He's so smart and funny and so intelligent and committed to this thing. He's, he and I have been friends for a long time, and I've learned to appreciate his talent and his friendship even more in the last 6 weeks than before. He is absolutely dedicated and a brilliantly creative, funny guy. It's a great performance. Now, in the fact that we're not going to New York, it's going to become legendary, and it'll be the stuff of legends. Well, I saw the production in Chicago with Nathan Lane and with Stephen Ouimet and some great Chicago actors, John Judd and Hugenacker and Mark Grapey, and a fantastic cast of Chicagoans, too. It's a very, very special show. And, of course, it's not the kind of thing that's done all the time. It's rarely done, this play. It's hard to do. It's expensive. It's long. It's difficult. It's very demanding. And it's a very special evening in the theater. And Falls did as good a job as he's ever done. And I just respect him as much as anybody I've ever known in my life. He's a fantastic director. You're lucky to have him in this town. But we're lucky to have Chicago. We're lucky to have the audiences, and we know that. We're all aware of that.
I got this text, Brian. It says, I saw Brian get into a Corvette at Knott's Berry Farm in California with Morgan Fairchild 30 years ago.
How old is that person? That was a long time, yeah.
True story?
Yeah, probably.
You and Morgan over at Knott's Berry Farm?
It could be. I did go out with her for several months, I guess it was. With Morgan, it was always, it was like going to the butcher shop and taking a number, And when your number
Sausage.
Came up, you went out for a couple of months, and then the next guy was there.
But right.
A great lady. I mean, she's just a terrific person. Beautiful, of course. Which was mainly the reason for a beautiful woman to be seen with me in those days, Corvette or no, was unusual. We had a great time. I always had a lot of respect for her and affection for her, but she was. I mean, there's only one Morgan Fairchild, and there always was. I mean, she's just very, very special.
Now, I'd like to see a picture of that.
I can't imagine what the hell I was doing at Knott's Berry Farm, but
yeah.
It must have been her idea, because it wouldn't have been mine.
You were taking a number at the butcher shop. That's what you're doing. Brian Dennehy, always a pleasure.
That's fun.
You can see Brian at the Goodman Theater in The Iceman Cometh through the middle of June. If you can grab a ticket for that, not a lot available. WGN.